Tensions are clearly rising in the East and South China Seas, and Australia can no longer pretend that it's business as usual. China's clearly pursuing its strategic ambitions in the region more aggressively in the past, and many Southeast Asian nations concerned are quite puzzled. What is certainly becoming increasingly clear is that Australia is no longer on the periphery of global affairs, but right next to developments that could have big implications. So are we ready to meet that challenge? Well, Alan DuPont is Professor of International Security at the University of New South Wales. He wrote a significant article on this in the Australian newspaper last weekend, suggesting that this represented something of an inflection point for us, and he joins us now on the line. I'd also like to welcome Professor Michael Wesley to the conversation. Michael's the Director of International Political and Strategic Studies at the ANU, and he's compiling a book on the new strategic environment right now, and he's been contributing to this of late too. So welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Good morning, Geraldine.
I wonder, Alan, if we could just even do a quick tour around the region to bring people up to date with just the range of things that are happening. The latest incident of a Vietnamese boat being sunk by a fleet of Chinese ships in Vietnamese waters this week confirms we really are seeing significant change, are we not, in how China operates in the Asia Pacific?
Yes, we are, Geraldine, unfortunately. Look, the incident you refer to started when China took a very large oil rig that it had developed indigenously and towed it into waters that Vietnam claims to be its own and started drilling for oil and gas unilaterally. And the rig was accompanied by about up to 80 paramilitary and naval ships. So it was a fairly provocative move, in my view, by China, and the Vietnamese were clearly taken aback and then responded. So we had a whole series of incidents stemming from that, ending with the sinking of a Vietnamese fishing boat last week, which would appear to have been rammed. Now, the point I would make is that this is part of a pattern of these incidents that have been taking place right across the South China Sea and also in the East China Sea. So it's right across the whole Western Pacific. And this has been slowly but steadily escalating over the last 3 or 4 years, and China has been involved in just about all of these incidents with its neighbours.
Now, that's the Paracel Islands, isn't it? Those ones off Vietnam, is that right?
That's correct,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, so then what's the Spratly Islands and the Half Moon Shoals on the... That's the eastern side of the South China Sea. That's near the Philippines, isn't it? What's happening there?
Yeah, that's correct. Well, with the Philippines, China has been involved in a number of disputes over small, really very small islands and coral reefs. And the point about these islands is that if you actually claim ownership of them, then you can claim all the resources under the sea, i.e. the oil, gas, and also fish, out to 200 nautical miles. So it's very important to establish territorial claims over these small islands, and that's what China's been doing. Now, the problem is, rather than negotiating with the Philippines over these disputed islands or shelving the territorial disputes and just going ahead with joint development of the economic resources, China has essentially been occupying them and building up these reefs and in some cases garrisoning them with troops. And because it has much greater military power than the Philippines has been pushed back and hasn't really been able to do much about it until recently. And now the Philippines has decided to prosecute Chinese under Philippine law and also take them to an international arbitration court. So they're obviously responding in a non-military fashion because that's really all they've got at their disposal. They can't really respond militarily.
And finally, before we get into broader analysis, there's the Natuna Islands, I think it is called, owned by Indonesia, like really south, very close to us, which is also coming into contention.
Yes, that's right. And this has been a really, you know, particularly alarming development, and obviously from the Indonesian point of view. So these islands are clearly owned by Indonesia. They've never been in dispute like these other islands that I've just mentioned. If you look at a map of the South China Sea, you'll see they're way down south. They're actually 2,000 kilometres from the Chinese mainland. So it's very difficult to see what would be the basis for any Chinese territorial claim. Now, the China's never come out and said they've claimed it, but what they've been doing is allowing their fishing fleet to intrude into the exclusive economic zone of these Natuna Islands on repeatedly. And when the Indonesians have responded by sending in their constabulary forces to check out what's going on, Over the horizon have come these fairly large and often quite well-armed Chinese paramilitary ships to support their fishing vessels. So that's happened three or four times, and on the last occasion, the Indonesians decided to go public and were very critical. So that's also happened.
Okay. How do you see this, Michael Wesley? A serious ramping up, or is it understandable?
Look, I think it is a serious ramping up, and I think the very big question to ask is why China is doing this now, having spent the best part of a decade reassuring its neighbours that China is rising peacefully. Suddenly we've got a much more assertive Chinese posture on these disputes that they've had for some time with many of these countries, with the exception of Indonesia. The question is, why are they doing this now? And I think that is a very big and important question that needs to be answered.
Well, you talk about, in a chapter that you contributed recently, the sense of strategic claustrophobia in Beijing that is being experienced. What's that?
Look, I think it results from the fact that China is now more dependent on the outside world than it ever has been in its several thousand year history. So it relies very heavily on imports of resources and energy. It also relies on imports of component parts, and it's very reliant on external markets to keep its economy going. And I think there are those in Beijing and elsewhere in China that worry about the ability of the United States and some of its other competitors to manipulate those vulnerabilities in the outside world. And therefore, you know, there is this sense of real anxiety about the really key trade routes that China needs that are not under its own control.
Yes, well, Alan DuPont, you write about the Straits of Malacca as this critical, you know, this little narrow stretch of water that separates the Malay Peninsula from Sumatra and that connects the Indian and the Pacific Oceans. Quite romantic, actually, I find the Straits of Malacca. But you've written that within the next 10 to 15 years, up to 80% of China's oil and 50% of its gas will be imported by sea through this narrow straits. And like put like that, you can certainly understand how China would be feeling anxious. Quite what you do about that then amounts to good or bad foreign policy, but it certainly gives a bit of extra perspective.
Yes, look, Geraldine, that's right. It is important to understand China's motivations, as Michael's pointed out, and there's no doubt that the need to protect these trade routes, this maritime trade route from Europe, the Middle East, all the way through to China is a critical factor in Chinese thinking. And, of course, previously, the security for this sea lane had been essentially outsourced to the US Navy, the 7th Fleet. And the Chinese have decided clearly that they don't want this to continue any further. And as their resource dependency grows, that sea lane becomes even more critical to them. So you can understand their concerns about their resource insecurity essentially driving this. And the Chinese themselves refer to this as their Malacca dilemma. That is, any kind of anything that happens in that so-called choke point just south of Singapore to disrupt trade would be catastrophic for them. They can't allow that to happen, whether it's for environmental reasons or piracy or because of some kind of military conflict. So that's clearly driving their policy. The question, as you put, is, you know, what does Australia and what does the rest of the region do about that?
Yes, Alan DuPont and Michael Wesley, two strategic specialists, are joining us now, and we're talking about China's options and our options. Let's get to our options, because, Michael Wesley, you say that we need to reinvigorate and rediscover a sort of creative diplomacy that has actually characterised, you suggest, past Labor governments, but the most previous was actually very cautious. But you think we need to really explore our past a bit in order to work out where we go next?
Yeah, look, I think while Australia certainly doesn't have a direct claim or interest in the South China Sea, we need to be very clear that there are much broader interests that are important to us that are at stake in these disputes. 60% of our trade sails through the South China Sea. And more generally, the general global rules on freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas, are very important to Australia because we are a trading nation. So The contestation that's happening in places like the South China Sea will have implications for global rules on freedom of navigation. I think that Australia is being very cautious. I think at the moment Australia is trying not to offend anyone. But I really do urge Australian governments to think back 20 to 30 years when we did risk our relations with Southeast Asia and with China and with other important partners in order to bring about some sort of a resolution to the Cambodia dispute. So finding, recapturing that mojo, if you like, of creative Australian diplomacy, I think is important now.
Why are the existing regional entities like ASEAN so timid and weak? You cite this in terms of problem solving. It works in other parts of the world, doesn't seem to work in Asia so well.
Well, they are and they aren't, Geraldine. In one sense, the rules of regional organisations, including regional security organisations, is that if there is any of their members that objects to a particular issue being discussed, then that issue isn't discussed. It's called a unit veto rule within these organisations. That means that a range of regional organisations that try and discuss these issues are blocked from doing so if China objects to that, and it has been objecting to that. On the other hand, ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, is becoming much more vigorous in its lobbying and in its coming together and advocating a code of conduct to regulate behaviour in the South
China Sea. Yes, but China hates that.
China really dislikes it because it sees it is evidence that the rest of the region is ganging up on China. So China has actually said that it will enter into no negotiations in which part of the position of Southeast Asian countries have been pre-negotiated. So that rules out that as a particular avenue of solution. International law is also not particularly helpful in this case because the Chinese have stated exceptions to the International Law of the Sea Treaty. They have stated historical reasons for claiming the South China Sea. And it also tends to inflame the situation. So in the case where one claimant makes a provocative move, such as that Alan was discussing before, other claimants, if they don't contest that particular move, it's taken in international law to be acquiescence. So international law in this situation can actually be seen as actually inflaming the situation somewhat.
Mm. And just before I go back to Alan, you also say there's the particular elements of Asian understanding of hierarchy here, which we've had a sort of almost an egalitarian sense of, particularly of the global commons and the sea, access to the sea, that this could be changing, and this is something we really haven't grasped.
Yeah, look, I think it's very significant that China's assertiveness in this part of the world has started from about 2009, and I think part of the reason is that China has really rushed to prominence since the 2008-2009 global financial crisis. It's been acknowledged as, you know, one of the big key drivers of the global economy. And I think there are those in China that are saying, well, if we are so important, why aren't other countries, particularly these smaller countries, showing us deference? And there's an element of irritation there in Beijing's behaviour, I think.
Just finally to you, Alan DuPont, is all of this, do you think, going to be reflected in the Defence White Paper that's due out soon?
I have no doubt that there is a major reassessment going on within the White Paper team about what China's rise means for Australia, and if it's going to be less than benign than we all thought and all hoped for some years ago, what are the implications? Now, I just say two things about that, Geraldine. First of all, I think the wrong conclusion to draw is that we beef up our military forces in order to somehow take on China if things get out of hand in the South China Sea. I think that would be a mistake. That's not what we should be doing. And Michael is absolutely right. It's about integrating our policy responses. So we have a robust foreign policy supported by hard policy of defence, but our defence policy should reflect our many defence interests, not just concerns about China. And most importantly, we need to work much more closely with our Asian friends and neighbours, as well as the United States, to work out messages that have to be delivered to China if we believe it's just going to continue this kind of coercive behaviour. So I think it's a more sophisticated, joined-up approach that we're looking for here, not responding by building, you know, an aircraft carrier or something, as some have sort of suggested that we need to do. I think that would be a mistake.
Look, and we haven't even discussed ANZUS and my Malcolm Fraser's particular... That's for another day. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks,
Joe.
Alan DuPont, Bye. Professor of International Security at the University of New South Wales. Michael Wesley, a Professor at the International Political and Strategic Studies at the ANU. That story, a long, long way to run, and we'll keep our eye on it.